What I want to talk about for the next little bit is validation in families. And I want to talk about this in a very practical way. I want to cover a bunch of things. So first, disclosure information. I appreciate the plug for my book from Perry, but otherwise I'm not selling anything. And I don't have any ties to the pharmaceutical industry. So I want to talk about a couple of different things related to validation. I want to talk about what it really means to give someone a validating versus an invalidating response. This is a term that gets used sometimes in ways that are more reminiscent of Saturday Night Live than something that's useful. And I want to make it as useful as we can. I also want to talk about how this concept is actually related to borderline personality disorder and give you some examples from our work. One of the things that I do is run a dialectical behavior therapy program that has a couple of parts to it. One part is a traditional treatment program for adolescents and adults with borderline personality disorder and the host of other co-occurring problems that we've heard about. The other is that I run a DBT program for family members, for parents and couples and other family constellations, which it turns out to be an extremely useful and fun thing to do. And unfortunately, there aren't so many programs like that in the world. So I'm going to give you some examples from our program as well. And then I want to talk very practically about how reducing invalidating responses or increasing validating ones does make a difference. It makes a difference for family functioning and for the family members within the family, as well as individual well-being. So we'll kind of walk through this together. Okay, so what are they and why do they matter? First of all, I want to be clear that when we talk about something that's invalidating, it doesn't mean that necessarily what the person's doing is mean or cruel or abusive. Of course, being mean and cruel and abusive are also invalidating, but you sure don't need a new concept like validation to understand that those are harmful things to do. So, of course, those are validating, but that's not really the things that we're mostly talking about. In the same way that validation isn't necessarily, invalidating responses are not necessarily neglectful or uncaring or even dysfunctional. Actually, many invalidating responses are pretty warm, pretty nice, very well intended. And this can be very confusing for people. Therefore, they're not necessarily pathological. So being invalidating doesn't necessarily look awful. In fact, it doesn't even look bad sometimes. So what it does mean, though, is that something about one person's experience, their valid behaviors, if you will, especially what the person's wanting, what the person's feeling, what the person's thinking, are missed or misunderstood, not paid attention to, disregarded, minimized, misunderstood, sometimes criticized, and sometimes pathologized. But those are things. And that sometimes even invalid behaviors, okay, that's interesting, that somebody actually could have an invalid behavior, sure. That an invalid behavior, especially something that's passive or dangerous, could be legitimized. Okay, so what does that mean? Well, let's think about this. So let's say, anybody here ever, do you ever have a thermostat war in your home? Yes. Obviously, everybody knows what I'm talking about. So the thing is that if you think about it, now temperature is an easy one. Okay, well, it's easy, but we still have trouble negotiating it. But if you think about it, if you come home and you're cold, or you're the warm one or the cold one, it doesn't make any difference. And so you, let's say you're cold, so you turn the thermostat up and the heat comes up. Okay, you're comfortable a little while later. And then whoever you're living with comes home and turns it back down, or maybe way down, because they come in and they're thinking, oh my gosh, wow, what are we living in, a steam bath here, you know? Okay, now that is, in and of itself, of course, that's invalidating, right? Now, it's not even directed at you, but it's saying, gee, I'm hot. Not thinking about the reasons why I might be hot, why the reason someone else might not be hot, I'm simply responding to what I notice about my experience, which indirectly invalidates yours. It says your being cold is not all that important. Now, It's not necessarily all that bad, okay? But this is sometimes when we have the wars, right? Person ducks into the bathroom, whoosh, turn it back up. So now people can negotiate temperature, right? You can have a conversation which might be light or could be intense, but you could negotiate it. You could find a temperature that you either might both be comfortable, or a temperature at which one person could put on a sweater or wear a blanket, or another temperature at which the other person can take off their sweater or their shirt and wear around a t-shirt and, you know, boxers for the, you know, the winter. As a family therapist, these are some of the solutions that I've seen people come up with. But what if instead of it being the physical temperature, what if it's the emotional temperature? What if it's the emotional climate in your home? That's much harder to adjust. And so when we talk about validating and invalidating responses, sometimes we're not talking about things like that are even as easy to recognize as temperature. Maybe I'm a person who likes emotion, that I kind of thrive on emotion. Maybe I'm just an emotional person. A lot of people like that, but maybe you're not an emotional person. Maybe emotions make you uncomfortable and you don't like that. So when I come home from an ordinary day at school or at work, I have a lot to say. And not only do I have a lot to say, but I have a very enthusiastic way of saying it. Okay? Maybe. So the reality is that could put a lot of pressure on you if you're a less emotional, more staid kind of person. Notice here, there's nothing wrong with either of these relative extremes. They're just differences in the same way that people might like the temperature to be 75 in your house, or might like it to be 62 in your house, right? Or 58, like it is in my house sometimes. So does this make sense? So if I'm the emotional one, you could kind of start to cringe when I'm, oh, there's Alan. He's having one of those days, you know, where he's got a lot to say and a lot of intense ways of saying it. You could just kind of cringe. You could actually kind of hear me coming through the door and kind of, oh, I'm just not in the mood for this, and kind of avoid me. Now, that avoiding me, those subtle responses to me, that trying to kind of calm me down, when in fact I've just got an ordinary amount of enthusiasm, maybe a lot for somebody who's soon to be 50, but, you know, nevertheless, you know, we accept it better in three-year-olds, don't we? That's a kind of a shame, but that's another story. It's lucky for my six-year-old, though. So what we do is we do subtle things. Now, those could be invalidating responses, even though, you know, you might love me, you might adore me, you might appreciate me, and you might not be able to stand it right now. Okay, so those are situations and responses that we could consider to be invalidating. Now, of course, there's more than that, and we'll talk about how this comes up. The second part here is important, too, that invalid behaviors can also be legitimized. That's a way to invalidate somebody, too. In other words, let's say, again, take a simple example. Let's say my six-year-old's trying to tie his shoes, okay, and he's not very good at it. Now, at six, is it reasonable for him to be tying his shoes? Sure. Okay, so now let's say that he starts doing it, and it's difficult for him, but he's doing it, but I say, never mind, you know, and he says, well, this is just too hard. And I say, it is too hard. Let me do it for you. Okay, can you see that? What I'm saying is he's incapable. It's not really valid that he can't be at least trying to tie his shoes. He actually can tie his shoes, but, I mean, let's say that I can't. Or maybe your adolescent, you wake your adolescent up to go to school, and he or she says, oh, I'm so tired. I had trouble sleeping last night. I can't possibly go to school. And you say, it's so hard when you're tired. Yeah, why don't you just stay home? That's actually, notice that's validating an invalid behavior. It's not valid. Anybody here tired this morning? You know? Okay, you managed to get your sorry butt in here. So, you know, that's part of being a kind of responsible person. We do things even when we're tired, right? That's part of it. So this is what we're talking about, and they're somewhat subtle things, often around emotional experiences and things that we want. You can want something even though there's no chance you're ever going to get it. Did you ever notice that people say you shouldn't want that? That's kind of invalidating. I could want it and just know that I can't have it. So we're going to talk about some of the subtleties and complexities of this. So when we talk about validating responses, there are actually a whole number of ways that one can validate. So again, imagine when we say validating responses, I prefer that term to validation per se, because validation seems it's like a thing, it's like an edifice. Really what we're talking about is how we respond to somebody, what they're experiencing, often what they're expressing, but sometimes what they're not expressing but still experiencing, how we respond. So one way, of course, is when someone's expressing something, feeling something, thinking something, wanting something, we can just simply listen and pay attention. That's one way to validate. That's communicating that I'm interested in what your experience is. We can also simply acknowledge the other person's points of view or experience. Oh, interesting that you feel that way. Now, this is a tough one, but this is actually one of the more important ones. When you're in a conflict, you know, when somebody says, you know, you are a big jerk, it's hard to validate that. Yeah, you're right, I'm a big jerk, you know. Which isn't, of course, validating because we're not big jerks. There's no such thing as a big jerk. That's a judgment, right? I can do things you don't like, and you could say, gosh, you know, you really did. I don't really like what you did. And I could acknowledge, yeah, I know you don't. Is much better than I didn't do it, or it shouldn't bother you. You see the difference? Okay? So acknowledging the other person's experience, reflecting, like, I know that you're upset with me. You say, Alan, you're a big jerk. I say, I know you're really upset with me. That leaves the crack of the door cracked open to start to figure out what it is that you're upset about. And I may not like you calling me a big jerk. It may be somewhat more colorful than that. Okay? I may not like that, but in fact, when I say, I know you're unhappy with me, I know I did something that upset you, that at least acknowledges the quality of your experience, which is that you're unhappy about something, you don't like it. There's some negative emotion about something I did. And it opens the door to start to understand what that is and to start to repair and communicate around it. Validating responses also include asking questions, working to understand. You say I'm a big jerk, catches me out of the blue, I don't have any idea what I did. I could simply say, no, I'm not, kind of defensively, reasonably, but not very helpfully. Or I could say, what did I do? How come you're so upset with me? I'm not in a defensive, like, you shouldn't be upset with me, but in an interested, what happened? What did I do? How come you're so upset with me? I'm sincerely interested in understanding that. Sometimes a person actually has a reaction that has parts that are pretty reasonable and understandable and normal, and other parts that are not as normative. Doesn't mean wrong, just not as normative. It's important to try to normalize the normal parts and to say, of course you feel that way. You know, if you're driving down the street and somebody pulls out in front of you in a car, cuts you off, and you have to slam on your brakes, and you say, whoa, that's really scary. The person sitting next to you says, yeah, of course you're scared. Right? That, they don't say, now, why is it that scary to you? Because that just asking that question would be a little invalidating, wouldn't it? So completely obvious. They've been sitting in the car. Then they see what happened. So sometimes you have to validate in a way, in a specific way, to actually be validating. And then there's also just this idea that you have to treat people as competent and not as fragile, but as an equal human being. That's also validating, which the converse is not validating. And then sometimes we just have to match what the person wants with our own vulnerability. And sometimes that's an interesting thing to do. So for example, if you go out on a date with somebody, say the first date, and at the end of the evening the other person says to you, gee, I had a really nice time. I hope we can get together again. Okay. Well, that seems nice. Okay. So you could validate, like, by listening and paying attention. Doesn't really work very well. Acknowledging the other person's point of view. Yeah, it did seem like you were having a good time. Well, something about that doesn't work either. How about asking questions? Now, what was it specifically that you enjoyed? Of course you had a good time. You were out with me. these don't quite work. What you really have to say is, me too, right? You have to say something that's like, you had a good time, you want to do it again. Me too, I had a nice time too, I'd like to do it too. Now, this is the matching with your own vulnerability. Notice the form of that, I had a good time too. It sounds like I'm disclosing something. It doesn't sound like I'm validating your experience, but really from an important functional perspective, what I'm doing is saying your experience makes sense and is safe in the world to express it. Okay, now that's a kind of a comical one, but what about when the other person says to you, you know, we've been fighting a lot, really been kind of really kind of nasty to each other over maybe hours or days or weeks or months or years. And you say to me, you know, I just hate this fighting stuff. It's just so, it's so awful. And I just want, I want to get along so much better. I want to try to put some of this behind us. Okay? Now that's, you're being vulnerable at that point. Now what lots of people do is take that opportunity to hammer the other person. Right? It's like, well, you know, it's about damn time, you know? And you know, that's not very validating. What's really required in that situation is you've got to let go of your attack mode and say, me too. I hate this too. I want to do this differently too. So there's a quality of that that's very important. And finally, sometimes we validate just by doing something, not by talking about it all day. You know, when you've turned the thermostat down and your partner or your child or somebody is cold, you know, you can get them a blanket. Don't say, of course you're cold. It's 58 degrees in here. You get them a blanket. You know, there's, sometimes we have to do things that actually improve the situation for the other person. Okay, now, what's the take-home message? Okay, validate the things that are valid. Validate the valid. A person's experience is always valid in the sense that it is the person's experience. It doesn't matter if the person's experience is based on some misunderstanding, faulty logic, right? Doesn't make any difference. If I believe something is going on and I'm sad about it, you know, if somebody tells me that my dog just got run over by a car, I'm really sad. It doesn't matter if they were wrong, it wasn't my dog. Right? You know, you could say, I shouldn't be sad, it wasn't my dog. But the reality is, I thought it was my dog, and I got really sad. And it may take me some hours to recover from that sadness. I can't just snap out of it and say, oh, thank heavens, it wasn't my dog, and go back to normal. Whew, I've been devastated. It's going to take me a while to kind of get back to normal. So validating the valid, often. And we can occasionally invalidate invalid things, right? So if I say, where's the bathroom? And you say, hey, I don't know where the bathroom is, actually. Where is it? I know it's out that way, but that way. Okay. So if I go out the door to head in that direction, it's good for you to say, no, no, not that way, that way. Right? So I'm going that way. You block me and say, no, no, that's not the way to go. That's healthy. That's helpful. Okay. But we want to do that seldom, and we usually want to, in meaningful situations, validate the valid first. You know, my oldest son, when he was in high school, he's now in college, for about 6 months, he worked on, gee, I want you to buy me a car. That kind of makes sense, right? You know, gee, I really would love it if you'd buy me a car. And so, of course, it's like, of course he wanted us to buy him a car. We had a lot more money than he did, you know? since he had absolutely no money, that wasn't hard. So the validating thing to do, of course, say, of course, I understand why you want me to buy you a car. Of course, I mean, I would want me to buy you a car, too, if I were you. No, you can't have a car. So before I say no, before I invalidate the invalid part, you got to validate the valid part. Instead of saying, you know, you selfish little guy, you know, you should, you know, or being critical. I mean, is it reasonable for a 16, 17-year-old to want the parents to buy a car? Of course, to want it. Now, the dialectic here is, of course, that just because the child wants it and it's reasonable to want it doesn't mean the parent has to do it. That's the tricky thing. That's where things get interesting, isn't it? Okay. So now I just want to be careful to highlight, it's very important then to validate the valid a lot, as often as possible. Invalidate invalid things, only invalidate invalid things and seldom. And very, very carefully, don't invalidate the valid or validate the invalid. Okay, did you get all that? Validate the valid, invalidate the invalid, don't validate the invalid, and don't invalidate the valid. And if you got that down, you'll be fine. All right, why does this matter? Okay, here's a little study we did. Now, I have to say, if my grandmother were alive, she would say something like, "You get paid to do this?" Really, she would. She'd say, "I could have told you that," you know. And in fact, every one of you could have told us this, but it's nice to see it in scientific terms. Okay, so what does this say? Well, if we look at this this graph, well, that's not, I don't need to ignore you people on the side there. Do I have a pointer or something? I can only do one side, sorry. But if you look at the two graphs, they start, these are measures of negative emotional arousal. That's the curve, okay? And this is, for our purposes, I've consolidated two kinds of measurement. We did psychophysiological measurement. We wired people up, okay? We got their galvanic skin response. We got their heart rate. We got their respiration band, their heart rate reactivity, a whole variety of things that were physiological indices of emotion. And we asked people to self-report their emotion, to actually tell us what they were feeling and how intensely. And it turns out that most of the physiological measures and the self-reports were essentially correlated. So I kind of collapsed them, took their averages, and put them on one curve so it's not so confusing. What you see are two curves. This is one group of young adults that have been randomly assigned to either, at the peak of their arousal, to get validated or invalidated. They don't know that, of course. Okay, that's the nice thing about being a researcher. You can do these kind of nifty things. So what happened was, not unlike Barbara Stanley's paradigm that she mentioned yesterday, what we did was we started out with people, we got their baseline levels of arousal, they're all pretty normal, and then we gave them very complex math problems. They actually weren't that, the whole idea was to stress them out. And they knew this. They said they were volunteering to be in an experiment. We said we were measuring stress responses, which was all completely true. And we just basically gave them these math problems that actually look easy but are very hard. And even if they got the right answer, we told them it was the wrong answer. What can I say? I don't think anybody got the right answer, but we didn't even know what the right answers were. Yeah, it's a little sadistic, I agree. But anyway, what happened, of course, is this. As you can see, the stress response goes up. Now, each one of these periods, there are a series of three impossible math tests. They're timed. They try it. They get the wrong answer, whether they do or not. And their arousal goes up, 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 up. And at the end of several of these, the whole idea is the experimenter at that point asks one question, says, "How's it going?" Okay? And then if they're in the validating condition, almost everybody says, "Gosh, this is harder than I thought," or "This is frustrating," something like that. Almost everybody says that. And if they're in the validating condition, the experimenter says, "Guess what? Of course," right? That's that. Remember that, of course, normalizing. Everybody responds that way. Don't forget, it's designed to be stressful. Okay, that's it. That's all it has. So like 10 seconds of simple validating response. Or if they're in the invalidating condition, the experimenter simply says, notice the pause. Really? Most people don't respond that way. And then goes on. Okay? That's it. Okay? Not like you're a big jerk, what an idiot, nothing like that. Just, really? Like your response is a little weird. Okay? Even though it's completely normal. In other words, the very definition of being invalidated. So, and notice what happens. And then, of course, they get some more problems to do that we tell them they get the wrong answer in. So what happens, notice, is that this is real, very much like real life. And what happens is if they've been validated, even though they continue to do these stressful tasks, their arousal comes down, 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 and hits another new baseline, which is higher than the bottom. So it's still stressful to do these math tasks and get the wrong answer. But not that stressful, a little bit more than when they started, but way less than at the peak of their arousal. But if they got invalidated, their arousal essentially doesn't come down at all as they continue to go through stressful tasks. I think this is exactly right, and my grandmother would have been right, that this is intuitive, but it's important to see it because these are unimportant tasks. Doing some math problems, nobody's going to keep your name. I mean, there were no negative consequences for getting the wrong answer. Not like real life where you're living with somebody and they're misunderstanding you and telling you your experience is bogus and wrong. Okay, so what does this tell us? Well, it tells us a couple of things, and this and a series of other studies that I don't have time to go into. Well, one thing it tells us and that we've learned is that when we are under a state of high emotional arousal, our ability to describe our experience, what we're wanting, what we're feeling, or just the situation accurately and descriptively, our ability to do that goes downhill. Okay? And we get what we often call is emotionally dysregulated, and associated with that are things like increased impulsivity and interpersonal reactivity. Now, what does that mean? Okay, so let me give you an example. So let's say you're waiting for your partner, or you're waiting for your child. Okay, it's the middle of the night. Okay, your son or daughter, your teenage son or daughter is supposed to be home at midnight. You've gone to bed. You wake up and you realize it's 12:45, and you notice that the light's still on. Okay, how do you feel?
Worried.
Right? Do you see how that's a kind of reasonable, normative reaction? I'm worried. Okay. Now, assuming that this isn't a regular occurrence, in which case you are sure that your child is fine and just flaunting the rules. Okay, that's a different. But maybe this is a situation where your child is not typically coming back late. Okay. Everybody. So worry is the reasonable. I mean, I'm guessing most of us would feel that way. So then you get up, and so you phone the child on the cell phone, or if you know where the child has been, you try that. Wherever they've been, no answer, nothing going on, you're still worried. So you try phoning the child's friend that your child went out with, no answer. So it's a bit frustrating in a variety of ways. So how are you feeling now? Now it's 1:15. More worried, right? Your arousal's gone up, up, up. And so then, you know, about 1:30, you hear a quiet key go into the door, and the door opens, and there's your smiling child. All the appendages are intact. There's no blood. Okay. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. Okay. What do you say? Well, be honest now, right? It's something like, where have you been? Maybe with some more colorful language. So now I want to point out what just happened was exactly this. Our arousal goes up and up and up. And then our ability to express ourselves goes down and down and down. Instead of saying, oh, honey, I'm so glad to see you. I've been so worried. We say, where the hell have you been? Right? It's very hard for the child to then respond with, I love you too. It's extremely difficult to do. Whereas if you were able to say, I was so worried. I couldn't imagine something bad happening, it was so awful. It's much easier for the child to say, oh, I'm so sorry for worrying you. It's much easier, right? It's easier to validate because the expression is accurate. But when it's like, where the hell have you been, you little creep, you know, or worse, it's much harder for the child to say anything like, well, why did I bother coming home to this, you know? And something ensues that's not so pleasant. And so this arousal expression thing is not a trivial one. And so when people have high arousal, their ability to describe their own experience, but also to connect it to the world, goes down. And we've done a bunch of things that actually show that's the case. So, okay, this has some implications. So let's link it back to borderline personality disorder now. Okay, so the essence here of the bigger model is this, that when our arousal is up, our ability to express ourselves descriptively and accurately goes down. And when our expression isn't very accurate, it's very easy to invalidate. Okay? If, let's say, I don't want to do something, like it's Friday night and you want to go out to dinner. You don't feel like cooking. I don't feel like cooking. Say, how about we go out to dinner? And I don't tell you that I'm really tired or I don't feel well, and I just go, oh, whatever. Then you say, okay, well, let's go. And you're excited because you want to go out to dinner. That's actually, of course, very easy. I want to point out that is invalidating my experience. And there's no way that you could do anything but invalidate my experience. So one of the take-home messages is I want you to not be thinking that every time we invalidate that's a bad thing, that you shouldn't do it, you should know better. Some invalidations are absolutely normative things to do given the circumstance. When the other person isn't accurately expressing, it's easy to invalidate their experience. And our contention is that this actually happens a lot in the development of borderline personality disorder. Okay, so here's the big model. Here's the idea. Okay, let me walk you through it. So start with the green box. The green box says that there's an event. Now, events, for our purposes, they could be big things like being in a car accident or having a boyfriend or girlfriend break up with us. Okay, but mostly, the vast majority of these events are little things. They're little tiny things, the things that happen dozens or hundreds of times a day. So when you go to work and it's a Monday morning and you had something interesting happen over the weekend and you're looking forward to seeing your colleague and telling your colleague about it, and so I say, oh, good morning, and you're busy. You're just on the phone. You know, you've got something to do. And so you kind of wave at me a little bit and walk on to do your thing. How do I feel? Perfectly normal. How do I feel? Disappointed, right? I wanted this much of a reaction from you, and I got this much of a reaction from you, right? And the differential between what I wanted and what I got, by definition, is disappointment. It's in the class of sadness, right? I lost. I didn't get something I wanted. Now, in this case, it's little. Now, okay, that's an event. Well, if I'm a reasonably regulated person, what do? I brush it off. Well, I brush it off, but I brush it off by doing a number of very healthy psychological things, like saying to myself, I'm disappointed, and accepting my disappointment as normal. In other words, I self-validate, which of course brings my arousal down, just like the graph showed. And then I go to work for a while, and then I try to catch up with you later. Okay? But if I have a lot of vulnerability, if I've got a temperament that means that my reaction is pretty big and very quick, and I can't calm down easily, my arousal goes up, 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 okay? That means that I get a big emotional reaction. And then on top of it, instead of thinking, of course I'm a little disappointed, I really was looking forward to seeing you and you're busy. Instead, I think, you probably don't like me anymore. I'm not very likable. I'm actually kind of a jerk. Or maybe you're a jerk. You should pay more attention to me. You know, you're my best friend at work, and you don't even have 2 minutes to say good morning to me. I start to do judgmental things. It was wrong the way you responded, or I'm a bad person for wanting it. Those judgments also jack up the arousal. So notice there are three arrows that point to arousal. One of them is the event itself. That creates a certain amount of arousal, but my vulnerability creates a certain amount of arousal. And if I judge you or me in this transaction, that generates even more arousal. Now, this vulnerability is partly temperament, things like just how emotional a person I am. Part of it's just my emotional baseline. Did I get enough sleep last night? Have I had enough to eat? Did I have too much coffee? Am I sick? Okay. Or did I have an argument with my wife before coming to work? Or all those things are different. I got lots of sleep, and I had a nice interaction with my family over breakfast. Those are buffers. Okay, so there's a lot of sources of arousal. But when my arousal goes up and up and up and up, if it gets to a certain point, I'm more likely to express myself inaccurately. And if this confluence of maybe what looks like a small event, but with my own judgments and my high vulnerability, I end up with a lot of arousal, I might do something like come down to your office 2 minutes later and say, how come you treat me this way? Whoa, how do you respond to that? Like, what's wrong with you, right? They're like, oh my gosh, do you really want to be my best friend? Okay, you're busy with a telephone call, and I'm like, why do you treat me this way? Not such an easy person to be around, right? It's hard. Now, I'm not saying that's not normal. I'm not saying there might not be other reasons for it, but I'm just saying in this relatively simple example, that inaccurate expression, what it really, of course, what the expression, an accurate expression would have been, hey, you know, I was so looking forward to seeing you, and you just kind of blew me off. I'm not quite sure why. Were you busy, or are you upset with me? What's going on is a lot closer to accurate expression, to which you can say, oh, no, I'm sorry, I was just on the phone. At which point, if I'm a regulated person, I can say, oh, okay, well, I'm sorry to bother you. And then you would probably say, oh, well, what was on your mind? How was your weekend? And everything goes along swimmingly, okay? But if I'm more sensitive, more reactive, have a harder time bringing my arousal down, that inaccurate expression comes out, you invalidate me, even by maybe rolling your eyes, maybe just looking shocked, like, what's up with this? Which, of course, then feeds back to increase my arousal some more. Of course, it also creates a specific history between the two of us, which is often the case when we're talking about parents and children or partners. Those specific histories have a lot to do with things. Anybody here ever been in a lousy relationship? I guess Minnesotans have pretty good relationships. Or there's a chronic dishonesty, one or the other. Based on what I know, I think there's chronic dishonesty in this room. Okay, so the reason I ask that is because, you know, you might have noticed that in a relationship that we might characterize as not such a good relationship, the other person doesn't have to do much to trigger a big reaction, right? That one little eyebrow going up, you know, is maybe enough, like, oh no, here we go again. And boom, flooded with negative emotion. But yet with somebody else, it would take a much bigger response to get the same negative emotional reaction in us. That's this part of it, that's just our history with that person also can make us more specifically vulnerable to those situations or that specific individual. So we aren't necessarily generalizing all of this to every situation. I could be very reactive to you individually, but not reactive to lots and lots of other people in my life, which is, of course, why sometimes our family members, and I'm including people with borderline personality disorder in this, but also other people who don't have borderline personality disorder, sometimes we react in ways that are rather puzzling. It seems like I was just so furious with you, but now I'm smiling and talking to somebody else in such a nice way. It can be very puzzling. We can start to think that I'm manipulating the situation, but in fact, they're just different situations. They call for different responses. You know, when you're in the water, you don't typically try to walk. You usually swim. And when you're on the ground, you don't usually, you know, do you move your arms like this. It's not so strange if you think about it that way. The environment changes. It pulls for different activities. Okay. So decreasing invalidating responses and increasing validating ones ought to make a difference. And this is maybe I'm just going to share just a little bit of some of the studies we've done to show how potent this one very specific thing is in transactions. So one is a pilot study we did with couples, distressed partners in distressed couples. And what I mean by that is that sometimes you can be in a relationship that's not very good, but individually you can feel, okay, I'm doing fine in my life, I'm not depressed, I'm not particularly upset. But oftentimes if you're in a relationship that's not going so well, it also has a deleterious effect on our individual well-being. Some of these couples, by the way, have one or more partners with borderline personality disorder and some don't. This was not a study where we exclusively took in people with borderline personality disorder, although there's a significant number in here. So what we did, I should tell you what we did. So basically what we did was a very brief intervention, which is just 6 sessions in groups around couple issues, but teaching people essentially how to express accurately and how to be more validating in response. Okay, those two keys, there are some other parts to it that it's not that easy to express yourself accurately when you're upset, and it's not that easy to validate when you're upset. So there are other parts, but basically the centerpiece was helping people to manage their emotion to be able to express accurately and to manage their emotion to be able to validate the other person, even if they didn't like it. And what we did was, in order to try to make this an even more valid kind of study, we didn't just ask people to self-report, which is important. We gave people standard questionnaires to ask about their relationship and ask about how they're doing individually and depression and so forth. But we also videotape them. We have them come into our offices and we leave the room and we put the video camera on and we ask them to talk about their relationship. And then we actually have somebody, this is one of those funny things in research, we call them blind observers. Now, how can you watch a videotape if you're blind? I don't know. But that's what we say. What we mean is that they're blind to, they don't know whether these people are in therapy or not, if it's before treatment, after treatment, from the community, happy, unhappy, they don't know anything about them. So they're blind to everything else. And we have them rate how validating or invalidating the partners are. So that's a kind of other way of introducing some more validity to this kind of study. Okay, and so here we have This is something called the brief symptom inventory, which is a very standard, simple way of looking at general individual levels of distress. And as you can see, the F stands for female and the male for male. Actually, these turned out to all be heterosexual couples. And consistent with the literature, women are more aware of their distress or have more distress, depending on how you think about it, than men. But in both cases showed significant reductions from pre to post, and it was maintained at follow-up. In men's cases, even though they started without a whole lot of demonstrable distress, they actually reduced significantly and continued to reduce in the follow-up period. So that's kind of nice. So this intervention had some nice effects in terms of decreasing individual distress into the normal range. And using standard measures of relationship satisfaction went from anything under 100 is considered a pretty unhappy relationship. The community standard on this scale is 114, and the standard deviation is about 14. So it's a pretty severely distressed group here down that was started. Both men and women were unhappy in their relationships. And by the end of the treatment period had squeaked up to between 105 and 107, which is better, but if you looked at the items and you had a relationship score of 105 to 107, you'd say, well, things aren't awful. They aren't exactly in the toilet, but this isn't exactly blissful either. But interestingly, continued, even after the end of the treatment program, to do better and better, at the end of our follow-up period, actually we're reporting completely normative scores of relationship satisfaction. So this was a very interesting set of findings for us because it was actually much bigger than what we expected. We were not by any means convinced that we were going to have such big effects in the short intervention. We were hoping simply to reduce invalidation and see if that moved anything. So here's what we found from our videotaped analysis. As you can see, both men and women at the beginning were less validating and more invalidating. Okay, high levels of invalidation for both women, men and women, and low levels of validation. And by the end of treatment, they had crossed over. They actually now were doing more validating responses than invalidating ones, both men and women. And here's where the treatment ended. And in the follow-up period, which was several months later, they continued to do that. So something about this stuck. It wasn't just an immediate effect that went away, as many treatment effects do, but actually hung in there. And when we did some other analyses, which are too complicated to go into at the moment, what we found was that actually this validating, invalidating stuff mediated their response. In other words, this seemed to be the central feature of what made a difference for them. Okay, in a different study, we looked at parents and their adolescent children, and I say approximately BPD because as Alec Miller told us yesterday, you know, this is sometimes you don't get necessarily all five diagnostic, you don't get all five things to get a full diagnosis, but these were kids with three or four or more, certainly had significant borderline features, and their parents. And then we did a matched control group. We took families from the community who weren't reporting distress and whose kids weren't in any way reporting borderline personality disorder kinds of problems. And as you can see, the clinic parents, the yellow, are much less validating and more invalidating than their matched controls. The controls were matched for things like age and family size and so forth. Now, this is not to blame parents, of course. The point is that when somebody's not expressing themselves accurately, it's easier to invalidate. And when you're being invalidated, your arousal goes up and it's harder to express yourself accurately. There is this whole transaction, and this is some good evidence for that. So, of course, we started to do some interventions with these folks, too. And the results of our interventions with parents were that we actually showed, actually in a very small number of sessions, significant reductions in invalidation. We actually didn't show big improvements, some modest improvements in validating, but big reductions in invalidating, which was a real success from our perspective. And that when parents did reduce their invalidation, it was clearly associated with improvements in their children. Children reported reduced distress, increased self-esteem, or reduced depression, irrespective of whether the children were in treatment or not. This is an interesting finding. So just by working with the parent, helping the parent understand the child's behavior a little bit differently and learn to respond to it differently, even when some of these kids, the things that the parents were invalidating were pretty normative things, you know, like, you know, I hate school. Okay, you shouldn't hate school, because it's kind of invalidating. And others were very quixotic, you know, the child's like, it's not saying much of anything. So the parent says, well, maybe you could tell me something, and, you know, it becomes much more subtle. And the post-intervention changes in the mothers, and we, unfortunately, like so many studies, we had too few fathers participate to actually have a meaningful data set, but we had enough mothers to do this. Actually, the mothers reported reduced depression and increased satisfaction in their relationship with their children. So this was very nice. That's not only was this helpful to the kids, it was helpful to the parents. The parents were reporting a lot less distress and burden. Of course, we need to do more research, follow this out with bigger samples and for longer periods of time. Okay, so I just want to kind of close with an example of emotion dysregulation and self-harm, because this is, I think, a common thing that we're faced with. So this is actually a real example. Actually, it's a real example times about 30 or 50 families that we've worked with. But so we have an adolescent daughter in this case, and she's struggling at school. She's harmed herself. She overdosed a few weeks ago, almost killed herself. She's out of hospital, back in school. So she comes home. So I'm going to just give you this from the parent's perspective first, okay? She comes home in the afternoon, and dad was home. She came home, it's late in the afternoon. Dad's home. He came home. He's actually stopped at the grocery store. He's putting some groceries away. She comes in. The door slams, big slam on the front door. Her book bag flies across the hallway and knocks over the plant stand, and the plant, the pot breaks, okay, that the plant is in. She just says, excuse me, fuck, and then just storms upstairs, leaves the plant, the dirt's like on the floor, the books are on the floor. She storms upstairs and slams the door. Okay, parents, how do you feel? Nice to see you too, honey. Right? Right? Okay. So, now, what do you think dad does? Okay, now notice he's got two sets of emotions, right? On the one hand, he's very unhappy that she comes home, she slams, she breaks, and she just leaves, doesn't clean it up. On the other hand, he's really afraid, oh my gosh, what's she doing? She overdosed a couple of weeks ago, three weeks ago. Is she going to do this again? Oh my gosh, I'm really scared. So he's got fear, and he's got some, yeah, he doesn't like this mess stuff than her just leaving it there. So what does he do? Okay, well, what are the options, right? He can do nothing, which is treating her as fragile. That's a kind of invalidation, right? Like somehow she's not capable of cleaning up the mess, okay? Or he can yell at her, which might be validating around the plant, but might miss something important. She came home pretty unhappy. Something's going on there. So he said, okay, I'm going to try. So he goes upstairs and he knocks on her door and says, what's going on? And she says, just leave me alone. Are you okay? I told you, just leave me alone. Well, you know, you left a big mess down there. Just leave me alone. Okay? And he's got this conflict. Like, what do I do? Do I push her to clean this up? But I don't want to push her over the edge. Do I just ignore it? But I don't want to treat her like she's got to clean it. So he doesn't know what to do. He's back and forth. He's kind of going crazy in his head, overthinking it. And so he heads downstairs, and it bursts out, well, clean up your damn mess. You know, I'm not your maid. Makes sense. I mean, it's not like the worst thing in the world. Okay. So now what he doesn't know, of course, is that what he missed out on was that at school, of course, she'd been in hospital. She comes back from hospital, and her friends are treating her like a pariah. And so her two best friends, both sat down at a table at lunchtime where there were only two chairs. Okay? In other words, don't sit with us. And then at the end of school, where they always would meet and then walk home together, the two friends were nowhere to be found. Okay? How did she feel? Pretty awful. Okay, lots of awful. So what did she start thinking about? She starts thinking about cutting herself, and she says, okay, but she's in treatment. And so she comes home, she says, okay, I've just got to go. I've got to be by myself, and I've got to manage my emotion. And so she heads upstairs, says, I'm going to do this, and she goes upstairs. She goes to her room with the intention of calming herself down. But dad's pounding on the door. She's breaking the plant, feeling like a complete incompetent. Dad's pounding on the door some more. Dad's saying she has to pick up this thing. She can't. You get the idea. So what happens is this transaction just follows, okay? And that he's well-meaning, he's trying, he doesn't know what to do. She's well-meaning, she's trying, she doesn't know what to do, but of course they clash. And what he's doing, of course, makes her feel worse. What she's doing makes him feel worse and more scared. His arousal goes up and up and up, and instead of saying, honey, I love you, I'm so worried about you, he says, clean up the damn plant. Makes perfect sense. It's hardly the worst thing in the world, but it's just enough more demand and negative emotion that she doesn't know what to do. I think this is a good example of the transaction. Okay, so what can we conclude? Well, first of all, we can conclude that families can play a key role in the development and course of BPD. Now, we can say that without blaming anybody. I hope you can see that there's no blame in this model, that we can do things that can certainly make things worse with the best of intentions, that even don't look bad. That validating and invalidating responses can be a key part in the process of emotion dysregulation and interpersonal chaos. And that family members suffer a great deal and shouldn't be blamed, but are relevant to treatment and are relevant to relapse prevention. Even if we aren't part of the problem, we can be part of the solution. That's very important. Families have to be, in my opinion, have to be included in treatment for themselves, because it's very difficult to have a loved one who suffers that much. It's very difficult for the person who's suffering, but it's very difficult to love somebody who's suffering, and we need support as well. And their patient relative. Having a family member in treatment has lots of salutary effects, which I don't have time to show, but have some important effects. And of course, we need a lot more longitudinal controlled research. As we've been hearing all weekend, we need more money to do this. And as you heard from Jim Payne, BPD research is way underfunded. So that's what I want to talk about this morning. And there's some collaborators of mine that I appreciate, and thank you.